Here this morning, I've still got some left over, and guess what? There's not a Mars nor a Milky Way in sight. I am blessed indeed. If any of you would like to finish those up, you are very welcome afterwards. Okay, let's come to the word Habakkuk this evening. If you need to look in your index, you're allowed to. It comes just after Nahum, but that's not much help, because if you miss Nahum, it's only a couple of pages long. You're snookered, aren't you? Micah is a bit longer. If you find Micah, just go on a little bit further. And just after comes Zephaniah. Zephaniah has got a few chapters in it. It's in the Minor Prophets. Habakkuk. I'm not going to make it easy by giving you a page number. Well, in mine, it's 1363. That doesn't help you at all. Anybody with a black Bible got a number? Stuart? Who? 1461, Selwyn. 1461. That's okay. Selwyn's on that as well. You wait till you're preaching, and you got to do, or you got to do the Bible. You don't find it beforehand. That's a nightmare. That's when you make yourself look really silly. Habakkuk. We'll read chapter 1. I really want to take us to the end of the book this evening, though. I'll read the last few verses before we finish. That's where I want us to end up. But we need chapter 1 to make sense of what's going on. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all the fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men, whose own strength is their God. O God, O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them in his dragnet so that he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. An interchange there, you'll realize, between Habakkuk and God. But now look what happens right at the end, because this is where we're going to get to by the help of the Lord this evening. Verse 16 of chapter 3, I heard and my heart pounded, my lips quivered at the sound, decay crept into my bones, my legs trembled. That was how he felt about the message of the Lord. Yet, says Habakkuk, I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. Though the fig tree does not bud, though there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer, and he enables me to go on the heights. Last Sunday evening, I can take you back. Last Sunday evening, we looked at the wonderful statement of Paul that we are more than conquerors through him, through Christ, who loves us. More than conquerors. Do you remember what we said? Being more than conquerors means that we tread them down, we put the opposition under our feet, but more than that, because we're more than conquerors, we make those things which would be against us serve us. They actually turn out to be good. We make them work for us. We don't just tolerate them. We don't just put up with them. We don't just survive. Through Jesus, who loves us, we can make those things our enemies that would destroy us. We can make them work for us. Easy, isn't it? If only. I mentioned how Paul had learned to live in that victorious state, one which we too can live in through Jesus. The scripture says we are more than conquerors through Christ that strengthens us. Let's not water that down. This is what is ours in Jesus. But it's hard. And I want to deal with that toughness. I want to deal with the other side of that this evening. It comes, I think, as a bit of light relief, as a bit of relief, to realize that not everyone in the Bible lived on that high plane that Paul lived on, always conquering, always content, you know, setting such a high bar for us to aspire to. I want to look at one of those people tonight, of which is, of course, Habakkuk. Habakkuk was a prophet. He was a man, therefore, presumably, who was secure in God. He had a relationship with God. He loved God. He walked in fellowship with God. And he was used by God to bring God's own messages to his people. He lived around the same time as Jeremiah, just to give you a little historical perspective, about the same time as Jeremiah. That is 600 years, give or take, 600 years, probably near 700 years before 600 years. Yeah, 600 is right. Before the birth of Jesus. 100 years after the northern part of Israel. Remember Israel, the nation was split into two. There was the northern half and the southern half. The southern half was called Judah. The northern half was called Israel. It's confusing because we just think of Israel as being a block. But they were two parts separated after the death of Solomon. Habakkuk lived 100 years. He ministered, he brought God's word to the southern part of Israel, Judah, about 100 years after the northern part had been taken into captivity by the Assyrians. That is important, that is significant. At this point in time, you see, Judah in Habakkuk's time was in serious, serious spiritual decline and under threat from the power of the East Babylon. And this is why it's significant to remember what had happened to the northern part, Israel. Because 100 years before, God had warned them, unless they repented, unless they turned back to God, unless they started to serve God, put him first, unless they turned from their wicked ways, that he would take them into captivity. And that's exactly what he did. Judah should have known better, therefore. They should have seen it. They should have learned the lessons. 100 years on, and they're making exactly the same mistakes. And as a result, at the borders almost of Judah is the might of Babylon. In our own country this week, we have seen the political might of one of the great world superpowers deigning to visit us and giving us the benefit, I'll be careful what I'm saying here, but giving us the benefit of his wisdom. There was more than an implied threat of a certain course of action in our nation. There is a sense that the great nations of our time, Russia, flexes its muscles in the Ukraine. It's like, who can stand against them? America flexes its might and kind of implies toe the line or else. That's not being political, but that's just what superpowers do. They are the superpowers, as others. In Habakkuk's time, it was Babylon, and they were at the edge of Judah. And as I say, they were in spiritual serious decline. And we catch something of that in the first part of this first chapter here. It gives us a little flavor. It was a country, says Habakkuk, that's marked with injustice and destruction and violence and conflict and strife and lawlessness. Those are the words that he uses. And it's a great burden for the man of God. And he's made it his burden and his mission to seek the Lord for help. That the Lord would come and speak and change the nation, turn the nation's heart back to him. But nothing is changing. He's praying, he's pleading with God, come please and change your people. Bring justice, bring love, bring integrity, bring peace, bring gentleness, bring truth and justice. But God seems to be not doing nothing. He remains silent and unmoved as to what was going on. And that was Habakkuk's first big beef with God. Habakkuk has two beefs with God in this book. And this is the first one. How can God look on at what is happening among his people and do nothing? How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Verse 1. The nation is going to the dogs. And despite his prayers, despite his preaching and his ministry, nothing is changing. God does nothing. It seems to Habakkuk that God is asleep at the wheel. Negligent, blind to what's going on. Unconcerned at what was happening among his own people. There's more than a hint of impatience and indignation about Habakkuk here, isn't there? How long, O Lord, must I call for help and you do not listen, or cry to you, but you do not save? His words are loaded with complaint, criticism of God, if you like. How can God just sit there and do nothing? You ever feel like that? It's one thing to say about rising up and being more than conquerors, isn't that? That's great. But let's be honest, sometimes we're looking and we're saying, God, why are you not changing this? Why are you not changing that? How can you let that go on? How can you let that person do that? Why are you not intervening? Why? I think most of us have times in our lives when we feel that. Well, now, how does God respond to that? What does he tell him? God's response is to tell Habakkuk that he He knows exactly what's going on. He sees it. And actually, Habakkuk, I am doing my own thing in my own time. I'm not sitting idly by. I'm about to do something, Habakkuk, and you will just be amazed by it. What he's going to do is to bring the and use the hated Babylonians, this nation marked themselves by violence and injustice, this godless nation. He's going to use the Babylonians to bring about justice and punishment on Judah, Habakkuk's own people. God's own people. Habakkuk's complaint is, Lord, why don't you do something? There's violence, there's injustice, there's wrong, there's destruction and violence, there's strife and conflict. Why don't you do something? Habakkuk, I'm going to do something. I'm going to bring justice. I'm going to bring punishment on these people. Justice and punishment to bring them into line. That was what Habakkuk was asking for, wasn't it? Here's the answer to his prayer. But God's means of doing that absolutely horrified him and brings a second complaint. If his first complaint is, God, why don't you do something? His second complaint is like, you can't do that. They're worse than us. You can't possibly use that kind of people. Verse 13. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up, notice this, swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Habakkuk's got three levels of argument with God here. Firstly, in verse 13, as we look here, it's like, how can you possibly use an unholy people? How can you use a people that don't fear you to do your work? How can you put up with them? How can you do this? It's against your character. You're a good God. You're a pure God. How can you use that which is impure? His second complaint, his second string of his argument is, but they're worse than us. How can you use these people to swallow up those more righteous than yourselves? That's not right. That's not fair. That doesn't work. And his third strand, tucked away in verse 16, in case you didn't notice it as we read it through, these were an idolatrous people. They weren't people that feared God. In verse 16, he says they sacrifice to their nets. They burn incense to their dragnets. Their gods were their nets. You know, if there's one thing that God hates, it's idolatry. What's the first command? First of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. Number one of God's hit list. You shall have no other gods before me. God, these are people that they don't honor you. They don't worship you. They sacrifice to false gods. How can you let this happen? It was idolatry was one of the biggest problems. It was one of the reasons why God would bring judgment on his people. He seemed to hate this more than anything else. How can you use a people that worship and bow down to fishing nets to do your work? And then I don't know what this, how you kind of think of Habakkuk. He makes his complaint to God, two complaints, and then he says, right, I'm going to go and wait to see how God answers me on this. And then how I will answer his response to that. Talk about cocky. Habakkuk is properly wound up. He's very perplexed. Not so much now by what God is going to do, but by whom he's going to do it. But you see, Habakkuk in all of this is guilty of double standards. In his anger, in his frustration, he's allowing his thinking to go astray. He accuses God of using a nation worse than the Jews, worse than God's own people. But the point is that for years, God's own people had been doing exactly the very things that the Babylonians were doing, but just in different ways. They'd been neglecting God. This was God's problem. This was the problem with the nation. The Jews had assimilated into their national life worship of all kinds of different gods, Ashtoreths and Baals, and the gods of the nations around them. They were violent. They were people who were didn't exercise justice. We read of it, didn't we? The strife. Do you see what we're saying here? He's saying you're bringing a people, you know, who are less righteous than us, but actually he's forgotten how unrighteous his own people are. And by implication, it's almost like he's saying, well, they're not so bad after all, at least compared to that lot. It's always a dangerous thing, isn't it, when we compare ourselves to others. Always a dangerous, dangerous thing. But Habakkuk was wrong. He was wrong to think that God wasn't doing anything. He was wrong to think that God didn't care about Israel flouting their God's laws. He was wrong to think that God's people were better and his people were better than Babylon. He was wrong to criticize God, and he was wrong to accuse God. What's going on here? What we've got here is gross pride and hypocrisy. And I don't want to be too hard on Habakkuk, but that's the truth of the matter. A man here who's got his thinking and the way he's looking at things is wrong. He's kind of built himself and his nation up as they're something that they're not, and there's hypocrisy because he doesn't see how bad they are. And the audacity that he's got to argue with God and to accuse him of getting it wrong, thinking that he knows better, that God should be doing it his way. It's not that he disbelieves in God per se. He doesn't stop believing in God. He just thinks that he knows better than God. He thinks that God should do it his way. And in his protests, he goes too far and shows a lack of humility before God. It's not so different from Job, is it? Job, who we feel so sorry for, who lost everything in complete innocence, was accused of all kinds of things. Job's problem was that he protested too much. He didn't see himself as God saw him. And in the end, God has to say, okay, so Job, where were you when I put the stars in the sky? Where were you when I made this? Where were you when I did that? Will you answer me this? Because, of course, you know all these things, don't you? Read about that at the end of Job. And that's the same kind of thing that's happening with Habakkuk. We have to be careful that we don't become insolent. We don't become proud before God. That in our questions of God, we don't slip into sin and accusing God of getting it wrong. I have no problem with people asking the question why. If ever you feel you shouldn't ask why and you think, I couldn't possibly talk to the pastor about that because I'm wondering why God is doing this, I have no problem with asking that question. Why shouldn't we ask why? To me, to ask the question is to start to find the answer. It's how we ask it. It's if we're implying in asking why that God should be doing it a different way. If we're accusing God of being unfair and unjust and unthinking and unfeeling, then we're slipping into the realm of sin. We just have to be careful of our attitudes. In chapter 2, we see God's response to all this. And he gave Habakkuk a vision. And the vision basically is that Babylon, this is his answer, he says, Babylon will not get away with it. We haven't time to look at this chapter. But in it, there are five places in verses 6 and 9 and 12 and 15 and 19. Each of those verses starts, woe. Woe to him, woe to him, woe to him, woe to him. These are woes from God against Babylon. And he tells Habakkuk that as terrible as the Babylonians are, he is actually in control of them. And in the end, they will get their comeuppance as well. And he ends, God ends with a climactic statement that we would do well to memorize. At the end of chapter 2, verse 20, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth be silent before him. God is in his holy temple. God is still on the throne. God is still the Lord. Let all people be silent before him. In other words, Habakkuk, don't be so proud. Don't be so arrogant. Don't try to tell me what to do. Don't tell me how to run my world. In answering Habakkuk's complaints, God doesn't justify himself. He doesn't explain himself. Why should he? I do think in our day, this is one of the greatest things, the stumbling blocks that people have. They expect that God is honor bound to us, mighty us, to explain himself. People aren't satisfied that God is God, that he can do whatever he wants. At the end of the day, this is his world and we are his people. This is the great intellectual stumbling block of many who are not Christians. They want the answers, don't they? And unless they can have answers that satisfy their IQ, their way of looking at things, they're not going to believe. And of course, you know the problem with that, don't you? It's putting us above God. It's saying, God's got to do it my way. We are the arbiters of what's right and what's wrong. We're the arbiters of what's fair and what isn't, as if we know best. God doesn't justify himself. God doesn't have to justify himself. It's important for us as his children to remember that, isn't it? Sometimes we just have to say, God, you're God. And that is where Habakkuk came to. You see, it's like God says, I'm in control. Habakkuk, trust me. I know what I'm doing. And I'm in control. And Habakkuk says, Lord, chapter 3, verse 2, Lord, I've heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds. Renew them in our day. In our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. And he goes on, and throughout this chapter, he records the great acts of God in the past, the God's acts of redemption for his people, he's recording here in poetic language. You look at it and think, what is he referring to here? He's referring to the acts of God for the Israelites at different times, the rescue from Egypt, the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, the parting of the Jordan as they go into the Promised Land, the driving out of the nations in Canaan as he gets in there, the way that God has gone before him, the miracles that God has provided. And it's like God, and he gets at the end here, and he says, I will wait for the day of calamity, for the nation to come. Though the fig tree does not bud, though there be no grapes on the vines, though the olive tree fails, though the crops have no food, there's no sheep in the pen, the cattle, no cattle in the store, all the things that were really, really important in those days. He said, though I've got nothing, okay, God, I'll rejoice in you. I'll trust you. I'll submit before you. Like Habakkuk, we have two choices. To continue to protest and say he should do it our way, give us what we want. That he should justify us, justify himself. Or we can humble ourselves and simply trust him. To trust our great and wise and good and powerful, our all-knowing, kind Father. That's the choice, isn't it? We either say, God, you do it my way, or we say, you can do it your way. There's a little verse tucked away in chapter 2, verse 4. It's the key verse, really. Chapter 2, verse 4. The righteous shall live by his faith. The righteous shall live by faith. We're called to live by faith. We're called to trust Jesus for our salvation. That's a step of faith. But we're called to live by faith. We're called to trust him by faith. We're called to live with him and walk with him and say, Lord, you have your way. I don't understand it. I can't see where you're going. I don't reason this. It makes no sense to me. It feels unfair to me, but God, if this is what you're doing, then I'm going to trust you. Now, some would say that's naive. Some would say that's simplistic. I think that I would call that faith. Wouldn't you? I'd call it faith. What else have we got to stand on? What other ground have we got? What other rock have we got? What other foundation have we got that will hold us firm? It is in the character and the nature and the faithfulness of our God, isn't it? That is where we are. We dress it up with fancy theology. We could use big long words. At the end of the day, it's saying, okay, God, I'm going to trust you. Faith says, I'm going to trust him. I'm going to trust his character. He said this, therefore I'm going to follow him. I trust him to know better than me. I trust him that he's going to make sense of this sorry mess. I trust him that he's going to reward me if I stick faithful to this situation and I don't go with my feelings and I don't go with my passions. I'm going to trust him that he knows and he's going to work it out and he's going to reward me and I'm going to get to heaven. And when I get to heaven, it will become clear. I'm going to trust him that all those who are criticizing me, all those who ridicule me, all those who mock me, all those who undermine me, those who turn their back on me, those who think I'm a bit crazy, I'm going to trust God that in the end, they're the ones that are going to have egg on their faces. That's where it is, isn't it? Who's with me tonight in making a stand on God? You don't have to answer me. In your heart, do you find that response that says, yes, I'm going to choose to trust God. I'm going to choose to trust the Lord, come what may. Though the fig tree does not bud, there's no grapes on the vines, though everything looks as if it's gone, I kind of changed it a little bit. I wonder if this might be how it would be today. Tell you what, here's the thing we could do in our life groups. I don't think we'll have time, but it would be a bit fun to do. To write a modern version of this little ending here. This is what I came up with. Though the company has no orders and has had to lay me off. Though we're in a recession and I probably won't get another job. Though there's nothing left in the bank and I've got to rely on a food bank and handouts. Though I've had to sell my car and my house and I really don't know how I'm going to get through this. Yet I'm going to trust God. I'm going to praise him and I'm not going to stop. It won't be easy, but God will keep me going, and he will enable me to triumph, even in the darkest times. Bit of a poor effort of modernizing it. But put your own version in that. What would you put in if it's all taken away? I probably ought to have health in there somewhere, don't we? This question for us is a simple one. It comes out from Habakkuk, because it's what God gave to Habakkuk. Who will we trust? Where is our foundation? What will we choose to trust? Will we choose to trust the Lord? The evidence is all there. Time has gone. Just have a look in here at what he's done in the past. Look at his promises. He's the one, we've pledged ourselves to him, isn't he? Haven't we? What else? Where else can we go? Was it the disciples said, who else can we go to, Lord? You only have the words of eternal life. If we turn away from him, what have we got? May God help us to trust him, not just in words, but in reality, in the ups and the downs of life, and the good and the bad, to trust him. And to find the joy, the peace, the comfort that comes